Good morning to everyone. We will begin with introductions from the court. My name is Mike Havikin, and I am the Chief Justice, and now by order of seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Justice Lindsay Miller Lerman.
William Castle, good morning.
Stephanie Stasek, good morning.
Good morning, Jeff Fulman.
Jonathan Papik, good morning.
And John Freitas.
Thank you, members of the court. And the first case of the day is State versus McGovern. Before we get to that, Mr. Ralph, good morning to you. And Mr. Hendricks, good morning to you. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin? Very good then. Mr. Ralph, you may approach and you may proceed. And I should say, we appreciate you having your masks on. Obviously, the court doesn't have masks on, but that's because we are going to be asking you questions probably. And we would appreciate it, obviously, when you approach to argue that you remove your mask so that we can hear and understand what you have to say. With that, Mr. Ralph, again, good morning to you, and you may proceed.
Morning, thank you. May it please the court, my name is Austin Ralph. I represent the state of Nebraska. This is an appeal by the state arguing that the district court abused its discretion in imposing an excessively lenient sentence. There's also a cross appeal by McGovern arguing basically that the district court erred in its rulings on his motions to suppress. My plan today is to first briefly address the excessively lenient sentence issue and then move on and discuss in more detail, more depth, the suppression issues. So I'll start with the excessively lenient issue as set forth in our briefs. We think our position basically is the district court abused its discretion. They imposed an excessively lenient sentence, that being the 5-year probation term for first degree sexual assault, class 2 felony. Basically considering the severity of the offense, as well as the lack of any factors supporting the imposition of probation, combined with what I think is an incongruity between the district court's sentence of probation on the class 2 felony with its sentence of imprisonment on the class 4 felony, which by statute, the district court must have necessarily concluded that there were substantial and compelling reasons not to impose probation. And obviously, if those reasons existed for the class 4 felony, we think they also exist for the class 2.
You say obviously, and your brief sort of said obviously, but we've never said anything about the effect, if any, of that statute that deals with the class 4s and 3As with respect to sentences on higher classification felonies, have we?
No, I mean, they only apply to the lower classification felonies, but as part of the statute, statutory language, it says, pull it up here, that it must impose, shall impose a sentence of probation unless, and then there's certain categories. The only one that could apply here is there are substantial and compelling reasons why the defendant cannot effectively and safely be supervised in the community. And I don't see any way to say that there are these substantial compelling reasons for the class 4 felony and not also for the class 2 felony.
Do you think that statute by its terms applies to the class 2?
No.
So what is it from a logical perspective? Is the sentencing factors might be viewed, the general sentencing factors mm-hmm. might be viewed differently from one count to another count, right?
Sure. But the sentencing, like, I mean, the factors, when you look at the 2260 that we're talking about in terms of whether to impose probation, it's, the crime neither caused nor threatened serious harm. The offender did not contemplate that his or her crime would cause or threaten serious harm, strong provocation, etc. And I guess in this situation, I don't see any means of distinguishing between the videotaping, which is the class 4 felony, and the actual assault, which is the class 2 felony. I mean, they're essentially the same acts, or same incidents, I guess you should say. And so the fact that there are substantial and compelling reasons not to impose probation for the video recording, I don't know how there wouldn't be also for the acts themselves. So yes, you could have different sentencing factors if say the sentence or the crimes were entirely different, say it was possession of drugs and first degree assault or something. But here they're intertwined. And so I don't think you can say we have reasons not to impose probation for the video recording, but then not also for the act that was recorded. So
that would be the limiting principle that you're advocating.
Yeah, that to me is the, as I said in a brief, incongruity between what the district court ultimately did.
Well, incongruity between counts in and of itself, it's, you're talking about similar counts from a essentially the same victim, same
right.
series of events out of the, even though they're charged as separate counts, they're not really separate in that, in the sense that you're talking about.
Yes, I think, yes.
Okay.
What do you think the proper sentence should be?
Well, a significant sentence of incarceration. If it were, I mean, if you just want me to, I guess I don't know a particular number. I just know that 5 years probation is not enough, considering what happened here. It's a pretty terrible offense, in my opinion. The video recording of the sexual assaults, the probing of the, you know, the genitalia, the keeping of those videos as a souvenir, basically, had an extreme effect on the victim herself. Even the district court noted, you know, that it was an absolutely searing statement by the victim. And so to me, you would need a significant period of incarceration. The range is 1 to 50, 10 plus, I guess, would be a starting point for me.
If the trial court had imposed a sentence of, we'll say 1 to 10, which would have allowed parole,
mm-hmm.
essentially the same time as the imprisonment on the other counts would have been completed, what would your argument have been then?
Well, parole, I think, is different than probation. It's not automatic, obviously. So I'm not sure if the county attorney would have done an excessively lenient appeal in that situation. But to me, there is a big difference between probation and any period of incarceration, really.
I beg your pardon. I do have a question. In your view, did the trial court adequately give its reasons or reasoning? And in your view, is there a difference between reasons and reasoning?
There is a difference between reason and reasoning, but we aren't necessarily talking about the class 4 felony where they would have to, I think, enunciate that more. Clearly, we're just talking to class 2, and this court, I think, has said in the past that the district court doesn't really even need to state its reasons at all for why it gives a sentence. The reasons that the district court gave here basically were, it noted the searing victim impact statement. It noted that the defendant had apparently done well or satisfactory, at least on the probation from the Buffalo County case to that point. And then had also said, you know, it's difficult to reach a balance on this case. I don't recall anything beyond that. It was relatively short in terms of explanation. But this court has said, you know, really no explanation is necessary. We're just reviewing for abuse of discretion at this point. So
how do we determine abuse of discretion in these cases? Most of the time, you obviously see the reverse.
Sure.
That it is, a question is the sentence too harsh?
Right. And obviously, it's a abuse of discretion is difficult to show. It's our position, though, that what we have here, you combine the severity of the offense with sort of a shock the conscience type of sentence, in my view, that probation for that offense combined with what I consider a disparity or incongruity between that and the class four felony that the district court here had to have concluded by statute substantial and compelling reasons not to impose probation for the class four. I just don't see how the same cannot be said for the class two.
You think the judge felt he was sentencing the whole picture with the sentence on the class four?
That probably played into it. I think opposing counsel kind of looks at it from more from a holistic point of view in his brief. But my position is that each individual sentence is essentially should be looked at more intently, more focused on the individual sentences, as we do with, say, Eighth Amendment proportionality. We say, well, we look at the individual sentence to determine whether it's grossly disproportionate.
We've not imported that Eighth Amendment jurisprudence into our general sentencing abuse of discretion jurisprudence, have we?
I don't believe so, no.
Before your time runs out, let me ask with respect to the suppression issues, is the state conceding that the first motion, that the first order of suppression was enforceable, correct, or otherwise?
No. Our position was suppression was not warranted, primarily because we think the good faith exception would apply.
I didn't see you articulate an argument that the original decision was wrong.
Well, because the rationale between, I honestly, I didn't necessarily follow the district court's rationale between the first and second orders. There were some sort of inconsistencies. If you were to say, looking at it de novo, I think the first order didn't necessarily make sense because he focused on the fact that it was searched, the cell phone searched by Grand Island Police Department. At least that's what he said in his second order. And I don't know the relevance of that because the Kearney Police Department had already searched it. So to me, that didn't really matter. But there was some miscommunication in the lower court. And so the state didn't file a brief. And so I think the district court went with McGovern's arguments, granted suppression. There was no appeal. But we think looking at it now as a issue of law, that the good faith exception would apply, even assuming the first search warrant was improper.
You articulate both the good faith and an independent source doctrine, which do you think is the stronger and why?
Probably the good faith argument, I would say, primarily because I don't know necessarily how to articulate it, but the good faith argument I think is stronger because the officer, I think it's hard, an officer is hard pressed to second guess issuing judge, I guess. And in this instance, the search warrant, there was at least some probable cause to support the issuance of the search warrant. McGovern concedes at least partly on the probable cause issue with the subscriber information. We think it also provided probable cause for other things. And then I don't think it was so facially deficient that a reasonable officer couldn't reasonably rely on it. It delineated the areas of the phone. It identified a crime that was being searched for, and it didn't have the catch-all language that this court decreed in Henderson. So I guess I would say the strongest is the good faith with my alternate argument following close behind. So unless this court has further questions, we'd ask that you reverse the judgment and impose a stricter sentence, but otherwise affirm the district court's rulings. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hendricks, good morning to you. You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is John Hendricks. I work for the Dowding and Erbaum Law Office. I represent the appellee and cross appellant, Jake McGovern. We're asking this court to overturn some of the decisions made by the district court and in regards to Mr. McGovern's motions to suppress pertaining to the search of the cell phone. And in doing so, I bring a three-tiered argument. Number one, the initial search warrant in this case was unconstitutional. It lacked probable cause to search for video. It lacked particularity. Number two, the videos that are issued in this case which were unrelated to the first search warrant. When those videos were observed, particularly the incriminating portions, it was not done in plain view, which of course then that made that description of what was observed made its way into the second search warrant. And number three deals with this juicy legal issue of the second search warrant, meant to cure the officer's illegal behavior and why that cannot stand. I say that's an interesting legal issue. I think it's one of first impression, but Your Honor, I believe that this case can be decided well before that. And that deals
I beg your pardon. Is it your position that we have not spoken to the ability of a second warrant to cure potential errors in the first?
Well, not in this manner, Your Honor. And I think what we're looking at here is, again, it's just a do-over. Law enforcement illegally searched the phone. That is clear. The district court ruled on that, and the state did not appeal that. So
is there any sort of issue preclusion or claim preclusion that applies to that in light of the phrase in the interlocutory appeal statute that says, in addition to any other right to appeal?
I think that's reading quite, I think there are options. And I think that a second warrant per se to cure some inadequacies is not per se wrong, but how it's used in this case. The idea is law enforcement didn't get the second warrant before launching off and investigating an entirely new offense. They built an entire offense on an illegal search of a cell phone. And then to take away that evidence from law enforcement, the idea to say, well, a year and a half later, search warrant together now. That's the problem here. I want to talk about that issue, but I'm going to start with in my order. And when we talked about the particularly probable cause issues in the brief, I can't regurgitate them due to lack of time, but I want to talk about good faith. I think that clearly this search warrant lacked particularity and probable cause to search for video of the offense. And so the question is then, does good faith apply? And I would ask the court to deny that for a number of reasons. The particularity issues. We know the problem here. Law enforcement over-relied on templates. They cut and pasted. And by cutting and pasting, which you know we all do, but we've got to narrowly tailor these the case in the end. But by doing that in the affidavit, they suddenly made this a sweeping search of everything in the cell phone for the limiting phrase of offenses or evidence relating to the offenses, plural, of unlawful intrusion. That language caused a lot of problems when they executed this. They were grossly negligent by not tailoring this affidavit and then search warrant to the facts of the case. This was systematic. This is what we heard, that this is how they do it in Kearney. The search warrant is one size fits all, and the only thing that changes on that search warrant is the description of the offense at the top. Now, our case law says
that from our record.
Yes, we do. The lead investigator from Kearney talked about that, and I think several of them did. Now, we know from our case law, this has got to be as particular as the circumstances allow. Maybe sometimes that's all you have is the offense. But I find it hard to believe that in Kearney, Nebraska, every search warrant that's as good as they can do is in terms of particularity. They just list an offense that they're investigating. Next, we got to look at the manner and how they use this unparticular warrant. There's no dispute here. They used this unparticular warrant. They used it and abused it time and time again to illegally search a cell phone for an offense they didn't have a warrant for. But because the warrant was so wide open, even though Officer Warrington helped with the affidavit, when we're talking in the motion to suppress, he's saying, well, the language of the warrant says offenses of unlawful intrusion, so I can look for anything. They recklessly chose to interpret the warrant in this fashion. And then lastly, it was reoccurring. It does matter that Grand Island, I think, searched this warrant, this phone without warrant. Kearney investigators did it. Grand Island investigators did it. This was a recurring issue. When it comes to probable cause, I'd ask the court to deny good faith. I'd say that this officer, it's unreasonable that he would rely on this warrant in terms of probable cause to search for video. He knew, this officer knew, that all he did was make a bare conclusion. There could be some video evidence on this phone, but that flew in the face of everything he knew about this case. And to describe that, what we have here is an individual in the apartment, the female walked to the bathroom. The male walked outside, parted ways. When that male walks outside, he instantly sees Mr. McGovern and chases him off. No cell phone is observed in use. When would a video have been taken? This happened almost simultaneously.
The video isn't the logical assumption that the video was taken while he was crouching outside the bathroom window peeking in.
But that was not what was seen by the witness. The witness says he's just crouched down looking in. There's no description of seeing a cell phone in use. And there's no time for that to have happened. If he was caught in the act and didn't have a cell phone out.
If it hadn't been a cell phone, just a regular disposable camera or a video camcorder.
Right.
Would we have different?
Okay, I think that maybe, but we
what would be the difference?
Well, there's only one purpose for that, but with a cell phone, obviously there's multiple purposes. And the problem here with that probable cause is to say, well, there must be video on here. Basically, we're saying because this individual had a cell phone at the time of the offense, therefore there's a fair probability there's video. You could say that about every offense under the sun.
Is this offense different?
I don't think so. And I come back to, it's caught in the act, there's no cell phone in use. The whole thing took minutes. When would that have happened? I believe that the officers shouldn't have relied on this affidavit. And the bare bones conclusion, that's the other thing, is there's nothing in the affidavit that sets forth why there's a fair probability that we would find this.
Does it make a difference that the cell phone was not recovered from the defendant, but instead was found in the yard?
I don't think so. I mean, if he was tackled by this guy and then arrested and they found a cell phone on his person, the logic would be the same. He had a cell phone on him, so therefore there must be video, or there's a fair probability that there would be video.
Is there any inference that this was a discarded or abandoned cell phone that was just found laying in the yard?
The state's never advanced that theory, and I don't think so. I mean, that makes little sense that somebody would run away, but throw the evidence back.
If they had evidence on them and they want to dispose of it, that might be a good reason to pitch the cell phone.
I believe the equal conclusion is, well, it probably was inadvertently dropped, and probably the more likely. I want to turn to the other issue that we had. I want to talk about the search of the phone. The district court here, look, to make clear why this was suppressed the first time, is the officer here, after seeing these videos, says, oh, I'm going to go back into the phone's 2017 phone history and dig around. Obviously, he's well outside the scope of the warrant. That's why there was suppression. And everything that flowed from that, he identified a witness or testimony and basically the key to the case. That should all be suppressed. That was suppressed. Then the second warrant comes. And the thing I would like to talk about, I guess I'll just briefly say, I don't believe that those videos were viewed while in plain view, while he's going through this first search warrant. He's got a list of videos. They all have dates on them. And I know that the court isn't going to limit the search based on the dates, and I would ask it to, but the kicker in this case is this officer has a technological ability, and he testifies about this several times, to validate that. So he can, through his technological means, he can say, okay, this date that says 2017, that's the exact date that this was placed on the phone. Therefore, he could rule out this stuff. He didn't do that. He just watched every video from end to end. The issue here is he could do that, and he did do that later. When he wanted to investigate these particular videos, that's the first thing he did. I'm gonna validate it and prove that that's the date that these were made. He should have done that and limited his search. The other issue with is that he continued to watch the video even when it became apparent that this was not a video that he was looking for. This wasn't somebody looking in a bathroom window. He continued to watch the video, and he was honest in his motion to suppress about why he did that. I was looking for another offense of unlawful intrusion. I saw some nudity and wanted to see what would happen. He's outside the scope of the warrant when he's making these observations. Lastly, Your Honor, the second search warrant. The only way this evidence is suppressed, the only way the state can get it back is to show an exception to the exclusionary rule. And for that, they've got to show, I believe, independent source. I'm running low on time here, so I will ask the court to look at that motivation problem. That's what this is all about. It's not what's just in the warrant. It's were they motivated to search, to seek that second warrant because of what they knew.
Before you sit down, would you care to respond to the state's arguments today, an argument about the sentencing issue?
Your Honor, I would. I think that it was a sentence that's obviously within the sentencing guidelines. The judge, I think, crafted a sentence that was supposed to include punishment, jail time, I think 1 year and 90 days, but also probation, recognizing Mr. McGovern's efforts of rehabilitating himself, listening to his discussion and his powerful statement at sentencing, and observing this case. And I guess my response to the state is saying, well, if, well, let's flip the sentences. If the judge had given him the year on the class or probation for 5 years on the class four and a year on the first offense, then suddenly this would be an okay sentence. I mean, at the end of the day,
isn't the probation term less than the maximum probation term on a class four now less than 5 years?
I guess I wasn't aware of that, but if it is, then
I may be wrong. I'm asking for
that. I could be, but you know, if you were to, the bottom line is the judge came up with a sentence that punished Mr. McGovern, but also recognized that he had made valiant efforts and taking this seriously and rehabilitating himself. And I think that's why we ended up with what we got within the sentencing limits.
Counsel, if it was, the court found that he was suitable for probation on a class two, is it plain error to find he wasn't suitable for probation on the class four?
I don't think so, Your Honor. As you laid forth, that's, those statutes don't necessarily affect one another. You know, and again, we're looking at the whole sentence here, that he was trying to maximize the probation time and also punish in a way that was suitable. And I think that, you know, I just believe that overall, the sentence that was announced by the court was reasonable and within limits. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? Thank you. There's no time for rebuttal. That concludes arguments on State versus McGovern. The court will next take up State versus Wood.